hurriedly approaching through the jungle beyond where the men lay. Crouching, staying close to the ground, Desmond and Herb ran up the hillside toward the two wounded men. Both medics were veterans, and they handled themselves expertly, staying apart, now diving into a shell hole, now dashing forward again. Desmond reached the wounded man from Company D and threw himself down by his side just as Schechter reached Glenn. Desmond examined the bloody face in front of him. The man had a large gash in his forehead. Blood had flowed into his eyes and dried. He was semi-conscious and moving. With a dressing and water from his canteen, Desmond began gently wiping the wounded man's forehead and eyes. As the blood and grime came away, the fresh face of a mere youth appeared. The dried blood that covered his eyelids loosened, and the boy opened his eyes. There, on the battlefield, with bullets whizzing overhead and Japanese almost on top of them, the boy smiled. His face lighted up like a star shell.
"I can see. I can see," he whispered. "I thought I was blind."
For a fleeting moment, Desmond shared his joy. He knew what was behind that smile. The boy had been hit, then he thought he was blind and left behind to die. Now life opened up for him again. That smile would remain in Desmond's memory as one of his greatest awards. It was for just this that the army had trained him, but he could not delay too long.
"Can you move?"
he asked. The soldier checked his limbs and nodded.
"Then start crawling back, and be careful. I've got to check this other man."
Several yards away, Schechter lay beside Glenn.
"How is he?"
Desmond called quietly.
"He's alive,"
Schechter called back. Bullets began whistling over their heads. The Japanese were firing in the direction of the two Americans' voices. Schechter jumped up and started running.
"Down! Down!"
Desmond cried.
"Hit the ground! Play dead!"
Schechter fell and lay motionless. Desmond was afraid his friend had been hit and crawled toward him, but Herb was all right. He had followed Desmond's orders too realistically.
"No more talking,"
Desmond whispered. He crept on to Glenn. His friend was unconscious. Desmond did not take the time to examine him carefully. He had to get him out of there. Working clumsily and with difficulty while lying by his side, he eased Glenn's poncho off, spread it beside him, then rolled him over on it. Schechter crawled up, and each grabbed a corner of the poncho. The bullets still buzzed overhead, and the medics did not dare even get to their knees. Instead, lying on the ground, they hunched forward a few inches, then pulled the poncho up behind them. Fortunately, they were going downhill. They had crawled only a few yards when they came to the body of a dead Japanese right in their path. They crawled over the body, dragged the poncho over it, and kept going. It took well over half an hour to get down off the hillside and then to a thicket. There, for the first time, they could straighten up. With the machete he carried just for that purpose, Desmond cut two poles and made a litter with them and the poncho. He and Herb eased Glenn's body onto the litter. Glenn's eyes opened.
"It's me, Dawes,"
Desmond whispered. He looked into Glenn's eyes for some sign of recognition. He clutched the injured man's hand and prayed,
"O Lord, if it be thy will, please spare this good man for those who love him. Amen."
Only a short prayer, but Desmond knew God would understand. He and Schechter picked up the litter and started back to the aid station. It was a clumsy burden, and they had a long way to go. The day was hot and muggy. They had to hold the poles not only up, but out in order to maintain pressure against the poncho and hold the litter together. They carried it for 200 or 300 yards before taking a break. Kneeling beside the litter, Desmond checked Glenn's pulse. The wounded man was unconscious, but still breathing. When they got their breath, they started forward again. There was still the danger of snipers, and they moved along quietly. They went uphill and down and splashed across two wide streams. They had to pause more often for rest now. The muscles in their backs, legs, and arms ached. Still, they staggered on. Two stragglers, riflemen, appeared, and Desmond pressed them into service. Now four men helped carry the litter, but it still weighed plenty. Just ahead now lay the aid station. One more stop, and they'd make it. They put Glenn down. Desmond knelt beside him. He felt for Glenn's pulse, but could feel none. In desperation, he tried again. But Clarence Glenn was dead. Grief-stricken, exhausted, dehydrated, Desmond remained on his knees, motionless, almost in shock. He had lost his best friend. He had no desire to live. He did not even have the will to move. The other soldiers saw him, noticed his condition, and called Captain Tan. They removed his helmet and his medical kits and got a handful of pills down his throat. Desmond didn't remember much after that. One of the pills, no doubt a sedative, enabled him to sleep the whole night through. Someone else obviously took his guard duty for him. This combination of drugs and exhaustion helped ease the shock of his friend's death. In the morning, he awakened physically refreshed, better able to put the loss of his friend out of his mind and carry on his duties. The death of Glenn had one distinct after-effect. From then on, Desmond never wanted to look at the face of a man he was treating. He did not want to know his identity, lest it be another friend. He would treat all the wounded to the full extent of his knowledge and get them back to the aid station for treatment as quickly as he could. But the death of Glenn had hurt him so that he tried to protect himself against a reoccurrence. One night's respite was all that Desmond could have. Heavy fighting continued with frightening casualties. The Japanese took their toll, and tropical disease and the elements took theirs. Strong, sturdy feet that would carry an infantryman 25 miles with pack and rifle could not withstand constant moisture. Jungle rot, which reduced feet to red, painful stumps, prevailed throughout the division. At least, Desmond thought, he was not having to argue the merits of a case of jungle rot with Captain Vernon. The determined company commander could not understand such weakness. On top of everything else, Desmond was not getting enough to eat. He lived on dog biscuits and coconuts, but even on Leyte, where coconut trees grew like pine trees in Virginia, there were not enough coconuts. The mature ones, those that had fallen from the trees, gave him diarrhea. In order to get the fresh ones, with pulpy meat he could eat with a spoon, he would have to climb the tall coconut palms. The natives had cut notches in the tree trunks, but they were an incredible distance apart. A barefoot Filipino in a pair of shorts could climb with much less difficulty than a soldier in uniform and army boots. But still, Desmond tried. One day, moving up into position, the column stopped. Though Desmond was weak and exhausted, he climbed a tall tree and threw down several nuts to the men below. By the time he got down to the ground, with patches of skin missing from legs and arms, he found that the men had long since gone on, taking the coconuts with them. Another time, in an almost identical situation, Desmond saw some coconut palms 100 yards or so off the road behind a hedge. He started toward them, crossing a ditch. Suddenly, the hedge seemed to erupt with machine gun fire. A Japanese ambush! There was Desmond, out in the middle of it, looking for coconuts. He turned and ran for the ditch, diving into it head first. His own men returned the Japanese fire and wiped out the machine gunners. Not one American was hit. Investigation of the Japanese position showed why. Empty bottles were lying around. The Japanese had tanked up on sake, their rice wine, and were so drunk they couldn't have hit a battalion. It was the only time alcohol had ever been to the benefit of Desmond Doss. Crossing the Ormoc River was a major objective. The battalion had crossed and made some penetration into the terrain behind it when it was decided that the penetration could not be held and the men should be pulled back across the river. But one of the men far up the line had been hit. Desmond, carrying a litter, went after him. Across the river, he ran into a sergeant who seemed to be sightseeing. The sergeant's job was to carry a heavy anti-tank gun, practically a cannon, on his back. It was the worst job in the company, and that morning the sergeant had announced he was through with it. He refused to carry the gun any further. Now he was due for a court-martial, yet here he was, up in the farthest penetration. "I'll help you, Doss," he volunteered. The two, now crawling, continued toward the Japanese, asking the whereabouts of the wounded man as they went. Orders were passed to withdraw, but 6 men volunteered to stay and cover them. Desmond and the sergeant continued on, and finally, practically within spitting distance of the Japanese, they heard moans and tracked them down. The man was conscious. "Where are you hit?" Desmond asked.
"Oh, my foot,"
the man groaned.
"Your foot?" the sergeant exclaimed. "We risked our necks and you're hit in the foot?"
"It hurts,"
the man whimpered. Desmond examined the wound. It was a bullet hole through the ankle and undoubtedly painful, but Desmond couldn't help feeling that if it had been his ankle, he'd have crawled, dragging it after him, or even walked on it rather than stay out there with the Japanese and wait for others to risk their lives. He and the sergeant rolled the man onto the litter. They pushed it along a few inches at a time for some distance, then risked picking it up and running for short distances. They got the man back safely, wounded foot and all. And the sergeant, who was brave enough to risk his life for a fellow soldier, was court-martialed and sent to prison in disgrace. The Japanese were everywhere. They shot medics and litter-bearers indiscriminately, but the wounded had to be cared for, and the medics had no choice. One day, Desmond, Herb Schechter, and the other litter-bearers were evacuating casualties across the Ormoc River. It was about 100 feet wide and only knee-to-hip deep, but no cover shielded them, and they were exposed to sniper fire from up and down the river as they crossed over. Desmond was on the left front stirrup, Schechter on the right. They reached the bank and climbed it, trying to stay as small as possible. At the top of the bank, they were outlined against the sky for a swift second. Desmond heard a bullet whine by him. It hit Schechter. He pitched forward. His corner of the litter dropped, and the wounded man fell off. Desmond pulled Schechter over the bank and ripped off his jacket. There was a hole in his back. He dusted it with sulfa and put a battle dressing on. He and the two other litter bearers hurried to the litter jeep with the man they had been carrying and came back with another litter for Schechter. He was still alive, and they carried him to the jeep. They were putting the litter on when a Japanese machine gun opened up. The driver jammed the accelerator down, and the jeep leaped forward. Desmond shoved the litter forward as hard as he could, and it stayed on. Desmond ran after it. He caught hold of a bracket on the rear and held on, running, jumping, being dragged, and sailing through the air. They reached the battalion aid station safely, but Schechter never regained consciousness. Another friend was gone. Again, Doss could take no time to mourn. The terrain was hilly in this part of Leyte. In the valleys, wherever the ground leveled off, rice had been planted and the ground flooded. Advancing across the paddies was particularly unpleasant, for they were anywhere from 1 to several inches deep in water, and especially dangerous because there was no cover. In such a field, a soldier was hit and cried out for a medic. The call passed back to the aid station, with the warning that the wounded man was in a dangerous and exposed position. Silence reigned for a long moment. No one wanted to go.
"Well, we can't leave him lying out there," Desmond said. "He could bleed to death while we're waiting for his position to be secured."
Desmond got the man's exact position from his fellow soldiers. "Be careful," they warned. "The sniper that got him is still out there." Desmond plotted his route carefully. He worked his way down the side of the hill, behind the retaining wall that surrounded the rice paddy. The wall petered out, but now he was at the paddy where the rice grew knee-high. It furnished some concealment, and Desmond crawled out into it. On the hill behind him, his buddies were firing across the opposite hillside, keeping the enemy down, giving Desmond cover. Somewhere in this flooded field, he knew as he crawled through the water and mud, was a Japanese with a gun. Desmond could be in those gun sights any moment. He refused to even think about it. The soldier, someone he had never seen before, had been hit in the leg. The bone was broken, and he had lost a lot of blood. Lying by the man's side, Desmond bandaged the leg tightly. Then he began dragging the man back toward the retaining wall. It was slow going.
"Hey!" he yelled. "Somebody come help me!"
An infantryman jumped over the wall and zigzagged to his side. The wounded man put an arm around the shoulder of each, and they half-carried, half-dragged him to safety. On top of the hill, one of Desmond's friends, a sergeant named Kelly, came running after him.
"Doss! I expected to see you killed any minute! We could all see it from up on the hill. You were crawling right toward that sniper. He had you in his sights for 10 yards. The good Lord must have been with you that time."
Desmond felt a sinking sensation in his stomach, and the backs of his knees felt a little weak. He uttered a silent prayer of thankfulness. Other men kept coming up to him and commenting on his escape. Several of them had seen the whole thing. Later, after he had taken the wounded man to the aid station, he thought about the miracle of the rice paddy. Perhaps the reason the Japanese did not fire was that he feared to give his position away. But more likely, Desmond felt, God directly intervened to keep him from pulling that trigger. Desmond was to tell this story frequently after the war. It became a part of Adventist lore, and was told all over the world, even in Japan. On one such occasion, a Japanese civilian came up after the services.
"I must have been that sniper," he said. "I was in just such a situation, and had a man in my sights as he crawled toward me. I tried to pull the trigger, but I could not."
The 77th fought on. To Valencia, to the Bungao, to Palampon. The same miserable conditions continued. There wasn't a dry foot on the island. Desmond came into the aid station with a litter case to find a messenger from B Company waiting for him. Captain Vernon had jungle rot, the messenger reported. After all the remarks he had made about the Shanker mechanics and the pill rollers, he now needed one of them, and nobody in the medics was breaking his neck to take care of him. "I'll fix his feet for him," one of the battalion surgeons said. "I'll fix him so he'll never walk on him again." But Desmond was already slinging an aid kit over his shoulder. Although the visit entailed a hike through sniper-infested jungle, although Captain Vernon's last words to him had been less than kind, Desmond never considered refusing to go. He was a medical soldier and a Christian. He'd take care of Vernon's feet. At the company command post, he found an unhappy captain. Vernon's feet were red with jungle rot, his face red with chagrin. Desmond knew what was going on in the captain's mind. The indestructible Iron Man lay in agony, both mental and physical. He wanted to be out leading his men. After all the remarks he had made about the medics, he now had to eat crow and accept treatment.
"Hello, Dawes."
"Hello, Captain."
Neither said anything more. Desmond went to work efficiently and calmly. He treated the captain's feet as best he could, applying a special ointment and loose bandages. A better man than he had once knelt at the feet of his disciples and washed them without making a fuss. Surely he, Desmond Doss, a medical soldier, could perform his duty with equal equanimity. When he finished, he advised Vernon to stay off his feet and keep them dry. Two extremely unlikely courses of action, and turned to go. His former CO started to say something, but the words did not come. Desmond understood. It's hard for a man like Vernon, a company commander, to apologize and express gratitude to a private. Shortly afterward, the man who had replaced Doss as company aide man died suddenly with pneumonia. Doss went to Captain Tan and asked to be sent back to B Company.
"Doss, are you crazy?" the captain asked.
"No, sir. I'd just like to go back to my old buddies."
Captain Tan sighed and arranged for the transfer. When Desmond reported to Captain Vernon, the CO received him gruffly. He didn't say he was glad to see him, but, the formalities over, Vernon cleared his throat and said,
"Doss, if there's anything in this company that isn't right, you tell me and I'll make it right. You understand?"
"Yes, sir."
Desmond knew that in this way, Vernon expressed both an apology and a welcome. There could have been no worse time to rejoin B Company. The men fought exhaustion as much as the Japanese as they pushed through one village after another. The Japanese made forts out of every house and peppered the attacking Americans with small arms fire. They had nothing to lose, for flamethrowers would be brought up to ignite the buildings. None surrendered. They'd take as many men as they could before perishing in the flames. In the all-out war in the Pacific, Desmond had little opportunity to show concern for the Japanese. He recognized them as fellow members of the Kingdom of God, but with differences. Japanese-American members of the churches Desmond visited in Hawaii had told him that in Japan, Christians were not given the opportunity to serve as medics. They either entered the army as combat soldiers, or their throats were cut. It was part of the military indoctrination to teach men to hate the enemy, and although Desmond never hated, the training did take some of the edge off his brotherly love. So many of his friends had been killed by Japanese, men like Herb Schechter, shot in the back while carrying a wounded man, and Clarence Glenn, that he could not help feeling some spirit of revenge. As for taking care of wounded Japanese, there were cases on record of these men lying on hand grenades and moaning for attention. When a medic rolled them over, the hand grenade went off, killing both. Japanese were told that they received some reward in their peculiar hereafter when they laid down their lives for the emperor, and taking an American along with them was even better. The natives, both the Chamorros on Guam and the Filipinos, felt absolute hatred for the Japanese. They told of atrocities, of soldiers raping girls on the street in broad daylight, and killing anyone who protested. The few Japanese taken prisoner on Leyte had to be protected against the Filipinos. Desmond saw a group of natives, bolo knives in hand, running after a truckload of unarmed Japanese prisoners. In spite of all this, when Desmond saw his first wounded Japanese, he felt inclined to help them. They had been brought into the aid station and were lying there, helpless. But an American soldier with a terrible stomach wound was lying with the same group of casualties. He kept crying out in his agony, pleading to be shot and put out of his misery. Desmond had done all he could for the American soldier and turned to the Japanese. Two walking wounded men, still carrying their rifles, saw what he was about to do and raised their guns.
"If you touch one of those devils, Doss," one of the soldiers warned, "I swear to God, I'll kill you."
And so Desmond Doss never treated any Japanese. He treated everyone else who needed help. When the company dug in for the night, Captain Vernon posted guards around the company area and also had booby traps set. These were hand grenades arranged with a trigger wire so that anyone crawling into the company area would set them off. One morning, Desmond heard a grenade go off, followed by the screams of a child. He grabbed his aid kit and hurried in that direction.
"Wait a minute, Doss!" one of the men cried. "We gotta disconnect the booby traps!"
When that was done, Desmond ran to the side of the victim. A little girl, about 5 years old. She was bleeding from a dozen different places, including the nose. Desmond feared she had suffered a concussion. The company was in battalion relief and might be called upon any minute, but Desmond remembered passing a small local dispensary with a nurse in attendance a few miles back. He wanted to take the girl there for attention. The company had two jeeps, but neither driver would take the child without Captain Vernon's permission. Doss ran to the captain.
"Both of those jeeps are loaded and ready to go, Doss," Vernon said. "You can't have either one of them."
"And just let the little girl die?"
Doss asked. Vernon gave in.
"Ah, all right," he said. "Unload one of them and take her on back."
The little girl's father came running up, and Doss put them both in the jeep. He went along, too. He saw that she would be given good care at the dispensary, then hurried back. The company moved out only minutes after they returned. One afternoon, a Filipino came into the company area to seek medical aid for someone at home. He was passed along to Doc, as the men called Desmond. The man's daughter had been wounded, Doss gathered, and he picked up his aid kit and went with him to see her. It was one of the worst wounds he had ever seen. Open to the bone, infected, crawling with maggots, and exuding a foul-smelling discharge. Doss wiped it out with a sterile battle dressing, washed it with water, sprinkled it thoroughly with sulfa powder, then covered it with padding and a dressing. The Japanese were putting up a stiff resistance there, and the company remained in the area for a few days. When Desmond saw the girl again, the sore was healing nicely. On another occasion, he was dragged to a native hut to take care of a baby.
"I'm not gonna take care of no baby," he protested all the way.
The army had given him no course in pediatrics, but he did the best he could. The baby had a high fever, both nose and eyes running from crying. Desmond gave the baby a quarter of an aspirin phenacetin caffeine tablet to bring down the fever and left another quarter to be given in 2 hours. He told the family to boil water before giving it to the child. That was all he could do. Next day, the young pediatrician returned to find the baby crawling around and laughing. Desmond got down on his knees and laughed with him. He'd saved his first baby. An old man who lived near the bivouac area had been hit in the leg with a shell fragment. It had become infected, and gangrene had set in. Desmond treated it as best he could, but this was a case for the hospital. The old man refused to go, however, because he feared he would never see his family again. He was old and ignorant and afraid. As a matter of fact, Desmond had to communicate with him through an interpreter. Finally, however, Desmond prevailed upon him to go to the hospital for treatment and arrange transportation for him through a rear echelon outfit. Members of the family, who also called Desmond Doc, were so grateful that they gave him bananas and their last egg. It was a little bitty egg laid by a scrawny, undernourished bantam chicken, and Desmond tactfully refused it. On learning that Desmond was a Seventh-day Adventist, people in the village told him that other Adventists lived on the other side of the peninsula. He asked if it would be possible to visit them, and they eagerly agreed, not only that it was possible, but that they would help him. Desmond hurried back to the company area, packed up both of his aid kits, and came back. He and his equipment were packed into a flimsy canoe, made of canvas over bamboo with delicate outriggers. A 14-year-old boy served as his guide and paddler. Out to sea they glided, making surprisingly good time. They rounded the peninsula. Desmond, looking ashore, saw a dead Japanese soldier. It occurred to him for the first time that this side of the peninsula might not be cleared of Japanese. He turned to the boy paddling and asked him if there were Japanese around. The boy shrugged. He did not know.
"What will we do if there are Japanese around and they start shooting at us?"
Desmond asked.
"I will turn over the boat," his guide said, demonstrating with his hand, "and we will get under it."
"Oh,"
Desmond said. He did not bother to inform the boy that he could swim at best a half dozen strokes. Fortunately, no one fired upon them. After a great deal more paddling, the boy turned in toward shore. As they came closer, Desmond saw women wading out into the water from the shore carrying earthenware jars. At a certain place, they scooped up water into the jars, balanced them upright on their heads, and walked back to shore.
"What in the world are they doing?"
Desmond asked.
"They are getting water," the boy explained. "It is a freshwater spring there."
Once ashore, Desmond was welcomed by the native people. They took him to a one-room schoolhouse where some 25 to 30 sick and wounded men lay on the floor. They were guerrillas who had been fighting the Japanese. One native nurse, with limited knowledge and virtually non-existent supplies, attempted to take care of them. Desmond opened up his two aid kits on the spot. If he had brought them $1 million in cash, he could not have been more appreciated. He helped the nurse with some of the most serious cases and left all the contents of both bags.
"I know how our missionaries must feel,"
he remarked to Jim Doris later.
It's a wonderful thing to be able to help people who are sick and in pain.
As the Leyte campaign continued, the bloodiest one yet, men fell all around Desmond, yet he was unharmed. He began to feel that he was receiving special protection from on high. Perhaps, he thought, physical exhaustion and emotional strain combined to make his fatigued brain more receptive to such a notion. Still, he could not put the thought out of his head that if he kept the Lord's commandments and did his work as best he could, he was keeping his share of the bargain, and the Lord would keep his. His regular reading of the scriptures only enhanced this dream. He turned again and again to the 91st and 93rd Psalms, which he believed had a special message for him. The 91st, in particular, seemed to fit him exactly. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress. My God, in Him I will trust. Surely he shall deliver thee from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence. He shall cover thee with his feathers, and under his wings shalt thou trust. His truth shall be thy shield and buckler. Thou shalt not be afraid for the terror by night, nor for the arrow that flieth by day, nor for the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor for the destruction that wasteth at noonday. 1,000 shall fall at thy side, and 10,000 at thy right hand. But it shall not come nigh thee. Only with thine eyes shalt thou behold and see the reward of the wicked. Because thou hast made the Lord, which is my refuge, even the Most High, thy habitation. There shall no evil befall thee, neither shall any plague come nigh thy dwelling. For he shall give his angels charge over thee, to keep thee in all thy ways. They shall bear thee up in their hands, lest thou dash thy foot against a stone. Thou shalt tread upon the lion and adder, the young lion and the dragon shalt thou trample under feet. Because he hath set his love upon me, therefore will I deliver him. I will set him on high, because he hath known my name. He shall call upon me, and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life I will satisfy him and show him my salvation. How appropriate were these words! Desmond accepted them literally. He had never questioned one word in the Bible. He believed that men inspired by God, moved by God, had written each thought expressed. Therefore, the Bible must be correct, all of it. The unfailing accuracy of the predictions of the prophets served as further proof. And when the 91st Psalm declared that He shall give His angels charge over thee, to keep thee in all thy ways, Desmond Doss accepted this as personal message. But Desmond was still mortal, and he still had trials to face. As the company fought its way into the mountains with hot days and cold nights, he began suffering alternate attacks of chills and fever. He shivered all night and could not sleep. He had volunteered to help carry smoke grenades, but for the first time in his military career, he found himself falling behind as the company moved forward. "Come on, Doss," the men encouraged him. Even Lieutenant Gornto looked concerned. But he and the other men had their own problems to attend to. It was dangerous to fall behind, for the division moved too swiftly to clean out all the snipers. Desmond stumbled along, tired, cold, with a hacking cough. He never dreamed it was caused by anything but the cold nights. Strange things happened to many men during this period of continuous combat. During his entire period of service with the 307th, Desmond had kept running into that one soldier who symbolized all the ugliness, the evil, which was to be found in the army, as in any group of men chosen from all walks of life. He was the man named Karger, the older, cynical product of the big city slums, who had first snarled at him that lonely night back in Fort Jackson when the shoes had come sailing over the bunks. It was the same man who had accused him of gold-bricking at the rifle range, and told him,
"Thus, if we ever get into combat, there's one man who's not coming back alive. That's you."
This was a man who seemed to care about nothing but himself and his own creature comforts. If there was any whiskey or sake, the Japanese wine, or native brew to be found, this man would find it. During the worst part of the Leyte campaign, Desmond saw this veteran troublemaker coming toward him. He prepared himself for the inevitable stream of curses. Instead, the soldier planted his feet, looked at Desmond through bloodshot eyes, and asked bluntly, directly,
"Doss, pray for me."
For a moment, Desmond couldn't speak.
Then he recovered his tongue. Why come to me? I'm no chaplain.
Nah, I already went to the chaplain, and all he could offer me was a drink. The chaplain's no better than I am, but you believe your religion. My time's running out. Pray for me, Das.
I will, the medic promised, but you've got to pray for yourself.
I don't know how, but when I get back to the States, I'm gonna start going to church.
Desmond reached out and clutched his arm.
You can't wait that long. We don't have that kind of insurance. You've got to begin now.
The man was near tears.
Das, you're the only man in this outfit who has any religion. Help me.
There are lots of men with religion here. Listen, the Lord can help you to live for what you know to be right. He will help you just as he has been helping me. You've got to make up your mind to prepare to meet your Maker in case your time should come.
I'll try, the soldier whispered. Thank you.
He turned and trudged off toward his own outfit. Desmond never saw him again. All campaigns must come to a close. The 307th's active participation in the Leyte campaign ended with the capture of the vital Labungao Road Junction. This completed the Ormoc campaign with a decisive victory, which led to the liberation of the Philippines. For continuing bravery during this important campaign, Desmond was recommended for the Bronze Star. The 77th Division moved into a rest area. While the rest of the men ate, slept, made plans with the local people, and swam in the Blue Pacific, Desmond Doss stayed in the pup tent he shared with James Doris and slept, slept, slept. Frequently, he couldn't even go to the chow line. Doris would bring him back something to eat. Gradually, he felt himself regaining his strength. After 2 lazy weeks, he was ready to go again. And this was fortunate, for the most demanding ordeal of all was yet to come. Chapter 5. One Busy Sabbath.
Hey, Das! One of the new replacements called. Have you heard the latest? Because we've been through 2 rough campaigns, they're gonna make us a reserve of reserves in this next one. That's pretty good, huh?
Desmond sighed. So many replacements. It was practically a new outfit. He didn't even know this young soldier's name.
Yeah, sounds pretty good,
he replied. No point in telling him what the old-timers knew. Reserve of reserves sounded good all right, but what it really meant was that the 77th would be held out until the situation was desperate, then thrown into the toughest, bloodiest fighting of all. That's the way it always worked. They had barely finished up the Leyte campaign, and here they were getting ready to fight again. Desmond couldn't help feeling some bitterness. Months before, they'd been promised a rest on New Caledonia. Well, they hadn't even seen New Caledonia. He was now supposed to have a Bronze Star, but he hadn't seen that either. Even if he had it, he could just see himself pinning it on his dirty fatigues. Captain Tan had taken it on himself to get his men promotions, and now Desmond was a private first class. After almost 3 years in the Army, he was 1 grade above the bottom, with a pay increase from $50 a month to $54. Big deal. In the spring of 1945, it was obvious to any American in the South Pacific that from here on, any operation would be a major, hard-fought struggle. As the Americans came closer to the Japanese homeland, the Japanese resisted fanatically. Wherever the next battle would be, Desmond knew it would be the fiercest challenge to the division and to himself. With the rest of the 1st Battalion, Company B left the bivouac area on Leyte and boarded the USS Mount Rail. This was the company's 4th transport. Looking around him, Desmond saw some of the old familiar faces on board. Captain Vernon and Lieutenant Gornto, of course, and Lieutenant Phillips and Lieutenant Onless C. Brister, who'd also seen a lot of action. There were 2 other Virginians in the company, William S. Carnes and Lewis R. Brooks, whom he knew well, and, of course, his fellow medic, Jim Doris. Some of the non-coms, like Sergeant Coons, had been given battlefield commissions and transferred as officers to other companies. Privates and PFCs had been promoted. Joseph R. Potts, Charles C. Edgett, and Clarence O'Connell were sergeants now, on their way up. Staff Sergeant John Mahalik, always one of the best-liked men in the company, had proved himself again and again in combat, and was one of the most respected men in the outfit and the most popular. But the missing faces outnumbered those present. Glenn and Schechter and the others, Desmond quickly pulled his mind away. Such thoughts were dangerous.
Northward steamed the convoy. Northward until it seemed that Japan itself was just over the horizon. Late in the day of March 23rd, a big island appeared. It was Okinawa, in the Ryukyus, little more than 500 miles from the southernmost island of Japan. It was common knowledge that the island bristled with weapons and was defended by large numbers of the enemy's finest troops. Other units of the 77th participated in comparatively minor engagements on the smaller island surrounding Okinawa. Company B didn't leave the ship, but it was in a constant war of its own, for it was during this period that the Japanese introduced the kamikazes, or suicide planes. The mount rail was under constant attack. During 1 5-minute period, the ship shot down 3 Japanese planes. The mount rail stayed off the coast of Okinawa for almost a month with its reserve of reserves, fighting off swarms of kamikazes. Almost with relief, the men of the 1st Battalion, 307th Regiment, learned that they would be getting off this ship and going into combat. "It must be pretty rough, or they wouldn't be calling us this soon," one of the men observed.
"It's always rough," Desmond answered. "But with God's help, we'll do all right."
Ashore, the men quickly heard many of the gory details of that strange and tragic campaign. The Japanese had convinced the natives that the Americans would torture and slaughter them. Horrified young Americans saw native mothers cut their children's throats, then their own, as the soldiers approached. In hysterical madness that caught all the civilians on the island, they slaughtered themselves and each other. The Okinawans buried their dead in large caves marked by strange, ornate entrances. Moving into the front lines, Company B stopped for the night just short of the combat zone. It was a desolate, fought-over area with shot-up tanks and destroyed shacks. As the men dug in for the night, Desmond noticed one of the odd-looking tombs within the company perimeter and entered it. It was dark and damp and permeated with a heavy, sweetish odor. Several large earthen urns stood in the back of the cavern. Desmond peered into one. In the dim light, he saw a skeleton. Desmond figured that this would be the last place a Japanese would enter. He bedded down in the tomb for the night. Darkness had hardly settled, however, before he realized he had made a whopping big mistake. He was alone and unarmed. If the Japanese came in, he was helpless. What was worse, he couldn't leave. If he came crawling out of that tomb at night, he'd be shot to pieces by his own men. It was a long night, and, as Desmond ruefully admitted to his buddies the next morning, he did more praying than sleeping. Before the soldiers advanced to their positions next morning, Captain Vernon pointed out the terrain to the company. The bivouac area was on a small ridge, looking to the south. The American forces had cut the island in two and were working southward. The major Japanese fortifications and forces occupied the rugged limestone hills of the southern part of the island. Across the littered valley rose another brown rocky ridge, known as the Maida Escarpment. Its slopes rose sharply from the valley, covered with huge boulders. At the top of the slope stood a sheer rock cliff, from 30 to 50 feet high. Maida Escarpment commanded the entire width of the island. From it, the Japanese could see the activities of the advancing forces from sea to sea and for many miles back. It had to be taken.
"On top of that hill and behind it," Captain Vernon told the men, "the enemy has built a complex of pillboxes, fortifications, and emplacements. 2 divisions have been cut to pieces trying to take that hill. Now, it's up to us. We will move up and take our position at the bottom of the cliff. From there, we will study the situation and make our plans."
The men looked around at each other. Company B had undertaken some dangerous missions, but nothing like this. Several of the men looked at Desmond. He tried to appear calm and reassuring. He knew his importance to their morale. A good medic could mean the difference between life and death, and Desmond Doss had proved himself to be a good medic over and over. In the early morning, under the cover of darkness, the company moved into its new position at the base of the cliff. There were big rocks piled together, making crevices, covering caves. Under the protection of the cliff, the company area seemed fairly safe. That afternoon, Lieutenant Gornto and Sergeant Potts explored the cliff and determined where it could be scaled. They cautiously climbed it and, keeping low, peered out across the hill. They identified several concrete and steel pillboxes and emplacements. They sent back to battalion headquarters for rope, a large supply of demolition equipment, and flamethrowers. Next day, they'd attack the escarpment. At daybreak, Potts and Edgett had their squads ready.
Desmond was with them. He knew they wanted him along. He was scared, but he was also curious. He had captured a pair of Japanese binoculars, and he hung them around his neck. If the view from the escarpment was so great, he wanted to see it. One by one, laboriously, they scaled the cliff. At the top, keeping prone, creeping on their bellies, they collected loose rocks. There were hundreds of them, pushed them forward, and built kind of a rock wall a few feet back from the edge of the cliff for protection. They secured one end of the rope to a boulder and dropped the other end over the cliff for reinforcements. Another squad climbed up this way. It was easier going. By keeping low, presenting little target, the small force managed to avoid drawing enemy small arms fire. There was no work for Desmond, and he squirmed around to face northward. The military importance of the escarpment immediately became apparent. He could see every phase of American military activity to the rear. Out to sea, he saw transports at anchor and landing craft bringing supplies. A geyser of seawater went up near one as a Japanese shell exploded. They were sitting ducks.
Boom!
The sound of an explosion came from the other side of the low rock wall. Another, and another, this time from behind them at the base of the cliff. Desmond had heard that sound before.
Mortars! He shouted. Knee mortars!
Knee mortars could be fired at such an angle of elevation that they could drop almost straight down. The little rock wall furnished no protection against a mortar attack. The Japanese were zeroing in. It was only a matter of minutes.
Pull back!
The word was passed.
Get back down the cliff!
Captain Vernon sent word of the withdrawal back to battalion and received orders to continue the attack the next day. Company A would also attack, higher on the escarpment, to the left. Three large cargo nets, the kind thrown over the side of the ship for debarkation purposes, were sent out from battalion. Pieces of timber were used to thread the three together into one large net. As dawn approached, Lieutenant Gornto called Doss to him. "You were pretty good with knots back in mountain training," Gornto recalled. "How about helping us secure these nets to the top of the cliff?" "Yes, sir," Doss said. He and a couple other men, lines secured to their belts, climbed the cliff. Keeping low, Desmond secured the end of his rope to a large boulder. Then they pulled up the net and made it fast. The entire platoon could now swarm the cliff in almost a body. Preparations complete, Desmond and the other men climbed back down the nets. Gornto would lead the assault. The major objective was a huge pillbox several yards back from the edge of the cliff. It was from this fortified vantage point that the Japanese were able to call down that dangerous mortar fire. Gornto assembled a squad of the toughest veterans, beginning with the three sergeants, Potts, Edgett, and O'Connell. Desmond volunteered.
"This is going to be a dangerous mission, Doss," Gornto told him. "You don't have to go."
"I feel I should, Lieutenant," Desmond said. "I may be needed. But, Lieutenant, I'd like to ask a favor before we go."
"Okay, Doss. What is it?" Gornto said.
"Sir, I believe that prayer is the biggest lifesaver there is. I believe that every man should have a word of prayer before he puts his foot on the rope ladder to go up that cliff."
What Desmond meant was that each man should have the opportunity to say a silent prayer himself. Gornto, however, called the group of men together and told them that Doss was going to lead them in prayer. Desmond had not thought about making a formal prayer, but he did not let his lack of preparation delay him. He stepped forward and said the first words that came into his heart.
"Our Heavenly Father," Desmond prayed, "please give our lieutenant wisdom and understanding so that he can give us the right orders, because our lives will be in his charge. Please give each and every one of us the wisdom and understanding concerning how to take all the safety precautions necessary in order that, if it be thy will, O Lord, we may all come back alive. And further, we ask that if there be any here who are not prepared to meet their Maker, they prepare themselves now through prayer before they climb the cliff. We ask all this in Jesus' name."
For another moment, the war on the escarpment stood still as the men remained motionless. Desmond was positive that all were praying, even those who had never prayed before. Then, confident, almost carefree, they turned to the cargo net at the bottom of the cliff, signaling to Company A to the west that they were beginning the assault. The members of the suicide squad, with their medic at their heels, climbed the cliff and without hesitation moved on across the top of the hill toward the enemy pillbox. Two tanks, 1,000 yards back, poured in a coordinated fire on the pillbox. It was ineffective. Now Gornto beckoned PFC Norman Black to come up with his bazooka. Black fired several times. The explosions uncovered an aperture in the side of the concrete dome, Under cover of two automatic riflemen from the flanks, one of the men ran forward and threw a satchel charge of explosives into the pillbox. Heavy logs, which had obviously formed as part of the fortification, flew up like matchsticks. A soldier rushed to it with a flamethrower and directed its full force into the gaping hole. No more resistance came from it, and the entire assault squad moved forward. They saw only a large hole. The sides had caved in, covering whatever openings had been there before. Covered by a light machine gun mounted on the pillbox, Gornto's squad moved out over the hilltop. They blew up several other pillboxes in the immediate area. Now the Japanese behind the edge of the hill began throwing hand grenades on the advancing Americans. The forward men in the squad threw grenades back. A furious battle ensued. Desmond was making himself small in a hole behind the rock wall. The forward men ran out of grenades and cried for more to be passed up. A box of grenades suddenly appeared at the top of the cliff.
"Pass them on,"
the soldier who had carried them up said. Desmond looked over the wall. The next man was several feet away. If he came back, crawled over the little wall, picked up the grenades, and returned, he'd be an easy target coming and going. It would be his life, and the men forward would not have their grenades. It would be their lives, too. Desmond picked up the grenades and passed them over the wall. It was the first and only time he touched a lethal weapon. In the meantime, Company A had failed to take its assigned position. The first five men to reach the top of the cliff had been killed instantly. But the Company B assault squad had secured a large area on the top of the escarpment. Gornto and Desmond looked around for any wounded who might need attention, and also for the dead. But there were none. In all this furious action, the squad from Company B had just one injury. Sergeant O'Connell's hand had been hit by a piece of flying rock. This was incredible to everyone except Desmond. Had he not prayed? Captain Vernon sent the 3rd platoon up on the escarpment to relieve the assault squad. Desmond stayed on top. He sensed that he would be needed, and he was. The end had come to that miraculous period in which a large group of men operated under a hail of Japanese bullets and hand grenades with no serious wound. It was as though Desmond's prayer had specifically covered one group of men for one period of time. Now that group had retired to safety, and the time was over. The cry, "Medic!" went up again and again, and Desmond crawled all over the hilltop ministering to the wounded. Then he would help them to the edge of the cliff and down the cargo net. Night came, but it brought no peace, no quiet. Japanese artillery and mortar fire increased. After midnight, a large group of Japanese rushed the men on the escarpment, throwing grenades, then joining in hand-to-hand combat. The Americans were forced down off the escarpment, and in the meantime, Japanese suddenly began appearing beneath the cliff. They oozed out of holes and crevices. For the first time, the company realized that the honeycombing of the hill extended out into their own area. The enemy was underneath them. When dawn broke after a wild night, Desmond Doss had gone to the aid of 18 men, including Potts and Edgett. Lieutenant Brister was in shock. 4 of the 18 men were dead. One of them was a company aid man who had just come in as a replacement. During the night, he had reached out of his hole for his canteen and was shot through the head. But as soon as dawn broke, Captain Vernon had his men moving forward again to recapture what they had lost during the night. Again, Desmond was with them. One episode followed another. A lieutenant was leading 3 men in a running attack on an emplacement. The lieutenant drew back his hand to throw a grenade. A bullet hit him, delayed the throw. The grenade went off, taking his hand with it and wounding the other 3 men. It all happened right in front of Doss. In a swift second, he had 4 men to take care of there on the bullet-swept hilltop. He fell to his knees among them. Men behind him were throwing grenades over his head into the Japanese lines. They saw Desmond, and the word was passed up and down the line to be careful. The grenades stopped coming. The Japanese began peering over the hillside to see what caused the cessation. "Don't stop now!" Desmond shouted back to his men. "Keep 'em coming!" The fellows started throwing grenades over his head again and to either side, keeping the Japanese down so he could finish the job. He had to staunch the flow of blood from the lieutenant's stump as well as from the other wounds and put dressings on the wounds of the 3 other men. 2 of them could crawl, and Desmond sent them back on their own. He grabbed the lieutenant by the collar and hunched him, a few inches at a time, back toward the edge of the cliff. An infantryman ran up and helped the 4th soldier get back to his lines. A little later, Desmond was crouched on the hillside watching a fellow soldier attack the mouth of a Japanese-held cave. The man fired several shots into the cave, then took his satchel charge and started to heave it in. Just as it left his hand, a bullet struck him. As Desmond watched, he saw the man's teeth fly out.
Cover me!
Desmond shouted to a pair of infantry men inching their way forward behind him. As they fired into the cave, Desmond ran to the wounded man, ripped open his shirt, located a hole in his chest through which the blood was pouring, and slapped a heavy dressing on it. The soldier was unconscious, but Desmond raised him up and got his arm over his shoulder. Clutching the wounded man's arm with one hand, holding onto his waist with the other, Desmond ran toward his own lines, dragging the wounded man with him. They reached the edge of the cliff, but it had been a needless mission. The soldier was dead.
Medic! Medic!
Came the shout. Desmond had no time to mourn. A shell had fallen in a machine gun emplacement far up the hill to the left. Desmond, stooped low, zigzagging, ran to the spot. Little was left of one of the men, just a disembodied hand still clutching the machine gun. The shell had blown the lower leg off the other man. His thigh was already swelling. Desmond bound it tightly, then began dragging the machine gunner toward the nearest point at the top of the cliff. A deep ravine cut through his path. A wooden ladder leaned against the side of the ravine. Desmond pulled it up and extended it across to the other bank of the ravine. It just reached. A rifleman was watching from a shell hole.
"Help me,"
Desmond said in a voice that was half plea, half command. The soldier came to his aid. Desmond backed out on the ladder, dragging the wounded man's head and shoulders. The soldier followed, helping as best he could. The ladder was old and rickety. It had been spliced in two places. It bent and creaked, but Desmond kept going, and his helper followed. The ladder held, and they got the man to safety. Day followed day, and still the fighting continued. The nights were as bad. Up in the escarpment, the Japanese kept up a constant grenade barrage and continued to infiltrate. Below, at the base of the cliff, it was even more dangerous. Men would find a crevice in the rocks, crawl into it, barricade the front, and sink into a coma of exhaustion. From behind them, Japanese would silently sneak out of a hole in the rear of the crevice and slit the Americans' throats while they slept. But an even greater danger was the endless barrage of mortar shells. In some places along the cliff, the base was eroded away, and the overhang furnished excellent protection. In front of one of these places, rocks had been piled up to furnish additional defense. One night, Desmond shared this cavern-like refuge with a rifleman in the 2nd Platoon. He noticed a large hole in the back of the crevice, but it seemed to go nowhere. Nevertheless, they decided it would be wise for one to stay awake while the other slept. 2 hours on and two off. Desmond took guard first, sitting back near the edge of the hole. After a few minutes, he heard a rustling noise, then some whispering. The sounds came from the hole, and the whispering was in Japanese. He awakened the soldier with whom he shared the hole and whispered to him to listen.
"Uh-huh,"
the soldier mumbled and resumed snoring. Desmond lay awake, hardly daring to breathe himself, listening to the mysterious sounds coming from the unseen enemy just a few feet away. When it was time for the rifleman to take his turn on watch, Desmond woke him again. Within 5 minutes, the fellow was snoring, and again the ominous rustlings came from beneath. All night, Desmond tried to get his partner to pull his turn at guard. He would promise to do so, but would not stay awake 2 minutes. Desmond tried to get him to change places with him. At least then, if the Japanese came out of the hole, they'd find the sleeping guard first. But though almost comatose, the soldier was too smart to change positions. The sleeping soldier had 2 hand grenades. Just one dropped down that hole would put an end to the danger, and Desmond could go to sleep himself. That night was the closest Desmond ever came to taking life, for he considered dropping those grenades. But he put the idea out of his mind. Though it could well become a matter of life or death for himself, Desmond would not break the 6th commandment. And so he stayed awake the entire night. During that night, he came to one firm conclusion. If he lived through it, God willing, he'd never spend another night either in that hole or with that soldier. The next night, he kept both those resolutions, holding up with Gornto in a protected place serving as the platoon command post. Just before dawn, Desmond heard the familiar cry, "Medic! Medic!" Intuition told him what had happened.
"You don't have to go, Doss," Lieutenant Gornto said,
but Desmond felt he had no choice.
"Pass the word along that I'm coming, so they won't shoot me," he said.
Feeling his way in the dark, whispering reassuringly in the hill country accent no Japanese could mimic to calm itchy trigger fingers, he proceeded to the cave where he had spent the previous wakeful night. Inside was one soldier. Another lay several feet away. Both were torn and bleeding, victims of grenades.
Probably the grenades had come from the hole where he had heard the Japanese whispering the night before. Desmond used up all his large battle dressings on the wounded men and sent them back to the aid station at daybreak. But he did not believe they could survive. The escarpment continued to hold up the entire American advance. Higher commands, from division headquarters to the Pentagon, were concerned about the Japanese resistance on that honeycombed hill. Press dispatches told the entire nation about the battle raging there. Of particular interest was the account of the first day's battle in which no one had been seriously injured, no one killed. Such operations just don't happen. A Signal Corps photographer came to the company CP 2 or 3 days after Gornto had led the assault squad up the cliff.
"I understand you had a fantastic operation here," the photographer said. "Blowing 12 pillboxes and not having one man killed."
"That's right," Captain Vernon explained the situation. The Signal Corps photographer looked at the cargo nets.
"We'll send somebody up with you so you can get pictures from on top," Captain Vernon volunteered.
"Oh, no,"
the photographer said quickly.
"I can take the pictures from down here."